Welcome to Keep Calm and Cook On. I am your host, Julia Tertian. Thanks to OXO, one of the most trustworthy brands I know, for making this episode possible. For more about OXO and all of the everyday objects they make, head to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. Today's episode is the final of season 4 of Keep Calm and Cook On. Making these 10 episodes has been such a meaningful experience, and I'm so glad to hear how they've resonated for so many of you. That is why I make this show. I will be back later this spring with some really special conversations, but in the meantime, I am so happy to end this season with God's Love We Deliver, an organization that cooks and home delivers nutritious, medically tailored meals for people who are too sick to shop or cook for themselves. They have been serving every New York City borough since 1985 and now also serve clients in parts of New Jersey, Westchester, Suffolk, and Nassau counties. God's Love We Deliver's work is a model for communities across the country. To support the health of their clients, they also provide ongoing nutrition assessment, education, and counseling. God's Love We Deliver is a non-sectarian organization that serves people in need and their children and their caregivers. All of their services are provided free to clients. God's Love We Deliver believes that food is medicine and that food is love. If you're a longtime listener of this podcast, you might remember a lot of this from episode 26 with my friend Emmett Findlay, who is God's Love We Deliver's manager of communications, and also Craig Palmer, one of the organization's longtime clients. Today's episode expands on that one and includes conversations with four longtime staff members who help turn the various wheels at God's Love We Deliver every single day. First up is executive chef Daniel Metzger, who really paints a great picture of what happens in the kitchen on a daily basis and all of the love and energy that goes into making the food. Next, I speak with Lisa Zulik, the director of nutrition services, to talk a bit about the considerations that go into the food that the clients receive. Next, I speak with Dorea Walters, the senior director of external program affairs, all about maintaining relationships. And lastly, I speak with Alyssa Wassing, the director of policy and planning, about how God's Love We Deliver works to make their services not only available, but also make them into policy. I wanted to return to God's Love We Deliver on this episode for a few reasons. First, it's a really wonderful follow-up to last week's episode with Christina Gill. Christina and I spoke about the various ways we can all be part of making a difference for those who need food. And these four individuals at God's Love We Deliver show us a variety of ways of what that can look like. Second, during the pandemic, God's Love We Deliver's work is more important than ever. All of their clients are living with underlying conditions, and the majority are elderly, meaning they're the most at-risk individuals. God's Love We Deliver's home-delivered meals are critical to their well-being. Third, God's Love We Deliver just established a culinary council, and I am a proud new member of it. I serve on this council with friends and colleagues who you might remember from other episodes of Keep Calm and Cook On, like Cicely Sierra Johnson and Mavis J. Sanders from Food Plus People, Liz Alpern from Queer Soup Night, and Zoe Ajonio from Zoe's Ghana Kitchen. So really, it's all in the family. The last reason I wanted to return to God's Love We Deliver on this episode is because in talking to people who dedicate their lives to providing meals cooked with love for a large and diverse community feels really tied to so much of what I share in my new cookbook, Simply Julia, which is all about healthy comfort food and figuring out what healthy comfort food looks, tastes, and feels like. Simply Julia will be out tomorrow, March 2nd, which is pretty amazing, and I'm so excited for it. Monday, March 15th, I'll be doing a really exciting virtual event with God's Love We Deliver. First, I'll be in conversation with the wonderful, amazing Carla Hall to talk about what healthy food means to both of us, and we'll focus on the joy of eating and cooking with kindness and intention. Then I'll be demonstrating a recipe from my new book. Proceeds will go directly to the organization. All of the info is in the show notes, and it's also on my website, juliatertian.com/events. Okay, on to today's very special and important episode. First up is Chef Daniel.
So my name is Chef Daniel. I'm the executive chef at God's Love We Deliver. And if I could just briefly speak a little bit about God's love, you know, we cook and deliver. This year, it'll be over 2.4 million meals to people, you know, too sick to shop or cook for themselves. This organization has been around for over 30 years. You know, there's so many people that need us. There are so many people that are hungry, so many people that are sick, so many people that are scared. God's love is going to be there for those people. And I'm so excited to be a part of that. So that's my brief little thing.
It's not a little thing. It's a huge thing. You said close to 2.4 million meals this year. I just want to repeat that number because that's quite a figure. What does that mean on a daily basis?
This is a massive operation. I think the kitchen is, if not the largest, one of the largest commercial kitchens in New York City. So this is not a small operation. We have thousands of volunteers every year, and the volunteers are really the heart of the organization. We have a very small staff here in the kitchen, maybe about 20 people, but the majority of our force, our manpower, people power, are volunteers. So every day we get deliveries in the morning, we process those deliveries. Volunteers are doing 90% of that work. And I mean, it amounts to over 10,000 meals every single day. It's just a beautiful thing to see. And I'm so happy to be a part of it. And it's really about the volunteers. You know, we could not do it without them. You know, that's it.
Yeah. Before we talk more about the volunteers and how you teach them and empower them, which I'm really curious about, I'd like to know just like a little bit more about you. And you mentioned how long God's Love We Deliver has been around, which is many decades. How long have you been with God's Love We Deliver?
So I started here at God's Love about 10 years ago. I started at the bottom. You know, I started as a kitchen assistant, sweeping floors and washing pans. And, you know, I slowly worked my way up to cook, then sous chef, and then eventually executive chef. And I think that's just another reason why this organization is so great, is that they really nurture people and nurture their careers and give people a shot. You know, I'm not like the traditional guy. I dropped out of school. I have a talk with a Brooklyn accent. You know, I'm a big gregarious fella, but the organization didn't care about that. They gave me a shot, you know, and I won't let them down. Just another great thing about God's love.
Any time I've been in the building and any time I've talked to anyone who works for the organization, there is such a tangible sense of loyalty and longevity and connection to the mission and the work. And it comes through in what you're saying. You've had other professional experiences in your life. I know you've worked in other, you know, in restaurants and stuff like that. And has that feeling about your work, that kind of deep connection, have you always felt that no matter what you do? Is that just you? Or do you think that's distinct to God's Love We Deliver?
I mean, it's definitely distinct. You know, I love what I'm doing. I love cooking no matter where I am. But when you get to cook, you get to do what you love to do for people you love doing it for. I mean, there's no better feeling than that. When I was working in restaurants and doing catering, you didn't really feel any type of connection. You're like, you're just pumping food out for people who knows.
Yeah.
For God's love, you're doing what you love to do for people who need it the most and for an organization who really supports the community and the people in it. And I mean, there's no greater feeling than that.
For you as the executive chef, I imagine your day-to-day life, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine most of it is in planning and probably cooking. And, you know, there's a whole just enormous team of volunteers that does delivery and is face-to-face with the clients that you're serving. And so for you to have that connection to the people you're serving, do you sometimes do delivery? Do you talk to clients? Do you get input from them or feedback? Like, how do you fuel that sense of connection?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, every year there's a service, sort of a service thing we do where people go and they do deliveries and they work in the meal packaging department, they work in the kitchen. So I personally go to clients' homes, not inside, but I go to their homes to deliver food. I wear my chef uniform. I'm very loud as usual. Chef Daniel is here. You know, I bring a I literally bring a pen and pad, and I ask them when I deliver these meals, how do you like the food? What would you like to see more of? What don't you like? And I literally am taking notes at clients' doorsteps because I care about them. I care about the food. I care about producing a good product for them. So I will bring a notepad when I come deliver. I will write it down. And then I take that back to the kitchen and we talk about it with the team. And we try to make those improvements that the clients want to see. So, you know, I read a lot of emails and client services sends me emails all the time. So, I mean, that's what it's all about. It's about the clients, you know? So as much as we can do to give them what they want, that's what we're here for.
Yeah. It's really wonderful to hear because I think so often there's an association that chefs, and especially executive chefs, people in your position, that there's a lot of ego in that position. It's a lot of like, this is my food or this is, you know, my style or whatever. And hearing you talk, it's so clear that there's no ego involved here. It's like, it's truly about serving the people you cook for.
I mean, I hate to jump in, but like food is love. And when you ever go to a party, where do people go? They're in the kitchen, right? So the way I think I show love and a lot of the staff shows love is through that food. We would just want to please people. And if I can please someone, I want to cater to what they like. That makes me feel good. It's not about me or my ideas or whatever. It's about making people happy and making people feel the love through the food. Mm. It's very powerful.
Yeah. In addition to food is love, the other kind of saying of God's love we deliver or mantra or whatever you want to call it is food is medicine, right? And I know that you say it doesn't have to taste like medicine.
Right.
This idea of medically tailored, how important it is for people to have, you know, nutrition that matches their needs. Where does flavor come into it? What do you think of when you say it doesn't have to taste like medicine?
Right. Well, so the line is food is medicine, but it doesn't have to taste like medicine, you know, and that's not just a good line. We're really doing it. So I mean, we have a team of registered dietitians that speak to every client or their caregiver or doctor. And then depending on that client's illnesses, that will then dictate what type of meal they get. So myself and the team of chefs we have here work very close with the nutrition department to make sure the nutritionals are on target. But then it's also the kitchen encompasses the city. Everyone in the kitchen, Spanish and Caribbean, and you know, we have all of these cultures that represent the kitchen, that represent the city. So what we want to do is leverage that. So we use a lot of traditional recipes, and I ask Vicente, hey, what was your grandma's sofrito recipe? And I ask Curtis his sister's jerk chicken recipe. And so those are the recipes that people like because those are those soulful, feeling involved. We want to invoke emotions when people are eating the food. It's not just about the nutrition. That's certainly a major part of it. But if the food doesn't taste good and the food doesn't make you feel good, you know, that's just as important, I think.
Yeah. Within my own work in cookbooks, when it comes to taking the photographs of the book, when I'm cooking the food for the photographs, I season everything, you know, like I'm making sure it tastes really good. And even if people can't taste that, I feel like it comes through and it's like that intention in the work. And hearing what you just said, it sort of reminds me of that. Like maybe one of the clients doesn't know the entire story of like whose sister's jerk chicken it might be, but that feeling, that intention, I believe in that kind of stuff. And it sounds like you do too.
I mean, it's absolutely true. This isn't just my job. This is my life. Mm-hmm. I live this. I go home. I test recipes that I want to bring back, you know, into this kitchen. This is like, I've met people in this kitchen and this organization. Now I consider them part of the family. Like this is a community. This is a lifestyle. Yeah. This is my lifestyle. I don't leave this at God's love when I go home.
When I lived in New York City, I spent some time volunteering at God's Love We Deliver, and now we live outside of the city, and Grace and I volunteer at a place that's basically, I always think of it as like a tiny version of God's Love We Deliver. We cook for like 70 clients at a time. And I know that when we're doing our cooking shift, I go in with a plan, right? Like I write down the menu, I write down what ingredients we need, and then inevitably something is a different size than I thought, or someone forgot an ingredient, or someone donated something extra that needs to be used up now. So there's always a plan and I almost never follow it exactly. And I'm able to be spontaneous and flexible because 70 people is not a small amount to cook for, especially just the two of us, but it's not thousands of meals. And I imagine there's so much planning, so much organization that goes into the meals, but is there room for that kind of spontaneity or can you not do that at that
scale? No, I mean, you have to be able to make decisions on the fly in the kitchen. Something goes wrong every single day that we didn't plan for. But what we do plan for is the ability to have that spontaneity. So if we get a delivery of extra eggplant or they didn't deliver enough zucchini or whatever the issue is, we do plan for that, you know, that versatility. You have to. There's no way you're going to feed 5,000 people a week without the ability to be flexible. And that makes it fun too, right? People like to complain when a problem arises. I'm like the happiest person in the world because, you know, it's a challenge. It's, you know, what can we move around to fix it? So I like those, the problem solving.
That's cool. I imagine if that wasn't your personality, you'd have a really hard time in your job, right? Like you're well suited for this. You said at the beginning that, you know, the volunteers are the heart of this, the heart of the kitchen, the heart of the organization. You know, I know what it's been like to be on the volunteer end of like a cutting board at God's Love We Deliver. And there's such clear instruction. When you come in for a volunteer shift, you're told exactly what to do, what the expectation is. You're given all the information you need to execute that well. You know, you're shown how to chop something, not just told to chop it. And I'm wondering about that teaching part of your job. And is that something you learned to do while you were at God's Love We Deliver? Like, what do you think about teaching? Do you enjoy it? What are your thoughts about giving volunteers instruction?
Yeah, so my mother's a teacher. And uncle's a teacher. So I grew up around teachers. It's something that I personally really enjoy. You know, I love being a chef and I love cooking, but I also love mentoring and I love, you know, teaching people new things and honing their craft. And it's almost as fulfilling as, you know, when I do something is when you can show someone how to do it just as good as you. It's something very fulfilling about that for me. But really, you know, communication is one of the most important things, not just in the kitchen, but in life. And if you have to be able to explain things as if someone has never done it before, it doesn't matter if you're 20 years experience or no years experience, you know, it has to be the same. But yes, I do love teaching. A lot of people here enjoy that. And the volunteers are like, it's like talking to your friend. It's like showing your friend how to chop carrots. I mean, it really is that close a family we have here.
Yeah, it feels that way. To me, it's just a good reminder of how much we get out of volunteering. You know, we're able to give a lot, of course, but like we're able to get so much out of it. And that feeling of community, that feeling of being part of something, that feeling of learning something new, like all of that happens when you volunteer. And I think sometimes volunteering is seen as, I don't know, some like real selfless thing or something. And I always feel like, no, you get so much out of it. Like, and sometimes, honestly, it's a relief to just be told what to do and follow the task and finish it. Like, I know I really enjoy that.
Yes.
Can I ask you a really silly question?
Yeah.
Okay. Each time you've leaned back, I've noticed in the pocket of your chef's jacket, you have a lot of objects. What do you carry with you? What are these objects?
This is the notepad. Remember the notepad we talked about?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm not just making this stuff up as I go along. I'm really doing this stuff. My notepad that I take my notes. And then, I mean, there's other boring stuff. You have thermometers, and this is like a little mini screwdriver, my thermometer. And of course, a fork. You have to have tasting.
Oh my gosh.
We have to taste you can't cook and not taste.
You have
that's what I got.
A toolbox in your chest pocket. I love this. It's so interesting to me, just the things that feel, I would imagine, essential to you. So essential that you have to carry them close to you.
I feel naked without them.
Yeah.
If I don't have my thermometer on me, I feel naked.
I love that. What I'm most curious about, what I feel like would be probably a really helpful thing for people to hear, no matter what they do, you know, whether they're running an organization like God's Love We Deliver or cooking at this scale, which probably most people aren't. But I think what a lot of people do is similar to what you do, which is go work really hard at something, try very hard to communicate really well, try really hard to incorporate feedback and to do a little bit better every day. Like, I think those things apply to so many people. And I'm wondering for you, you seem like you've always seemed to me just such a, you know, a warm and welcoming person and, you know, not afraid to raise your voice and all these things. And for you, what does it look like at the end of the day? How do you come down from a full day at your job and how do you prepare yourself for tomorrow?
I mean, this might sound a little sad, but I'm sort of upset at the end of the day. I want to, there's not enough, there aren't enough hours in the day for, you know, I would live here if I could. If I didn't have to sleep, I mean, because I have to sleep, right? I mean, yeah. I mean, I get sick sometimes over a long weekend, like maybe we're closed Monday for a holiday. I start to get like in a grumpy mood. Like if I'm not in the kitchen, you know it. Like I'm in a bad mood. It's like I'm going through withdrawal almost. No, but I mean, I love what I do. So, but I mean, I'm being serious.
Yeah.
I look forward to coming to work. I wake up without an alarm clock. You know, I'm jumping out of bed. People, it's like Monday and I'm singing, walking through the halls and people are like, what's going on here? Like it's Monday. Monday's my favorite day of the week, by the way.
I feel like you're the perfect fit for your job. Like that's so cool. And you are lucky to have your job. Your job's lucky to have you. Like, it's just, it's like you're the right puzzle piece. That's amazing.
Sometimes these things work out.
One final question that I ask every single person who comes on the podcast. When you were little Daniel, what was your favorite thing to eat when you were growing up?
Oh, so I mean, that's actually easy because, you know, I think about my mom and you know, during COVID, I really haven't gotten a chance to see mom as much as I like. And I haven't been hugged mom in a year,
wow.
You know, and that's something I really miss. And I can't wait to do that. But I think about mom and sorry, mom wasn't the best cook. Mom wasn't the best cook. But
not what I thought you were going to say.
Mom wasn't the best cook. But what I do remember mom made really well was French toast.
Mm.
And I remember waking up for school and mom would make me French toast. And that was probably one of the fondest food moments I can, as early as I can remember. I mean, I must have been 6-7 years old
wow.
eating mom's French toast.
So. On a school day, not like even on
a school day. On
that's
a school
special.
Day.
Wow.
And mom worked, single parent mom.
Wow.
Mom making me breakfast. Mom's a champ.
Daniel, thank you so much for your time and just for the positivity you bring to everything. You know, my smile is bigger after talking to you. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I said this to you before we aired, but thank you for your support and your continued to support. You volunteered 15 years ago. You're still going strong. You're not in it for the money. You're not in it for the fame. Congratulations on all your success, your books. I need a signed copy.
Oh, it will be my pleasure. I want to send one to your mom too.
Thank you to OXO for supporting not only this episode, but the entire season of the show. In addition to supporting all 10 of the conversations I've had this season, OXO also invests in the environment. They are a proud member of 1% for the Planet, which is a global community of brands giving back to environmental nonprofits. OXO gives 1% of their annual sales to organizations that impact sustainable food systems, cleaner air, land, and water, and environmental education. To date, OXO and the other brands in 1% for the Planet have donated over $270 million to organizations making a positive impact on the Earth. For more about OXO, all they do to give back, and all of their products, head to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. Next up is Lisa Zulig, the Director of Nutrition Services, who is one of the registered dietitians that Chef Daniel mentioned. It was great to talk to Lisa about her background in HIV care, which has made her so well-suited to serve clients with so many different types of medical issues. We also talk about the importance of culturally appropriate food. And just an FYI, Lisa and her team have made a ton of nutrition resources available for free for everyone. I've linked to many of them, including bilingual, downloadable booklets in the show notes. Lisa and her team are also happy to mail these booklets to people for anyone who might not need the service, but could benefit from the information.
My name is Lisa Zulig. I am the Director of Nutrition Services at God's Love We Deliver. I am a registered dietitian nutritionist, and I've been working at God's Love, 19 and a half years.
Wow.
I've been there. I started as a part-time dietitian, and I've just been, you know, I just love working there, and I just really, yeah, what we do is just amazing to me, and I feel lucky to be able to do it.
So November 2001, nearly 20 years ago, what brought you through the doors in the first place? How did you arrive?
My background, it was HIV care, mm-hmm. and I had been working at different adult day programs, and I worked part-time at a health clinic. And I was also involved professionally with some organizations, dietitians who worked in HIV/AIDS care. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of knew the players, and the woman who was my predecessor, I think she mentioned to me, you know, we're hiring. And so I went in, I went in the doors really saying, thinking in my head, like, I want to work here. Mm-hmm. And I had never really done that except when I was 15 and I applied for a job at Baskin Robbins for an after school job that I desperately wanted. And I got, and I had the same feeling about God's Love. Like, I really want to work here because, you know, not only do I get to work with clients, but I also, they develop great nutritional resources for the community. Mm-hmm. They give presentations to the community. At the time, it was mostly in person, you know, this 2001. It just seemed like every day was a different thing. We also were involved with the menu planning, obviously, food safety. So I felt like as a dietitian, it was a great opportunity to be able to do different things and just really learn different things.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like that has stayed true for this long.
Yeah. And then right after I started, we actually, you know, God's Love started as working with people just with HIV. Mm-hmm. And then in 2001, right around the time I started, we started expanding the mission to serve mm-hmm. People with breast cancer first. That was the first thing. Mm-hmm. So, and then we've expanded to over 200 different diagnoses. So from my team, you know, we're working with people with lots of medical conditions. So I think that's also interesting. It just keeps your brain going, I think, yeah. also how to be effective and work with different populations and different illnesses and things.
I have a very specific question about that. But before sure. I ask you, I feel like I really am just really desperate to know what your favorite Baskin-Robbins flavor is.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Okay. This is embarrassing. But when I work cookies and cream, was my favorite. And I used to, you know, the little tasting spoons.
Oh yeah.
So like when this is downtime, when it was boring, like when nobody was in there, we would just like pick out ice cream and just, you know, it sounds gross, but it wasn't gross, but I would pick out all the cookies. And so my boss said to me, he's like, Lisa, after you're done with this, we should just call this vanilla. I basically ate all the cookies out of it.
That's so funny.
So that was definitely my favorite.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Sure.
I feel like now I can really focus. I would have been so curious otherwise. So, okay. So you started when God's Love We Deliver was serving people living with HIV and AIDS. And then soon after, other diagnoses, now over 200. And I'm wondering how your background and expertise working with patients and clients living with HIV, how has that informed how you work with people who live with other types of illnesses?
You know, HIV care has changed a lot. And people with mm-hmm. HIV who are longtime survivors mm-hmm. have lots of other chronic illnesses. Mm-hmm. And also there are side effects from medications, like they may have renal disease or cardiovascular disease or diabetes, for example. So I had already brought in a lot of that knowledge to the HIV care as well. And so, you know, we are able to look at the different parts of the person's health and the whole person. I think it was a pretty easy transition mm-hmm. in many ways. I mean, there's a lot of different things to study and to learn about. One of the things that I specialize in also is gerontological nutrition.
Yes.
And I think that was really important because our clients are aging, mm-hmm. especially our clients with HIV are aging, but then our clients in general at God's Love are majority are over 60. So I felt like having, you know, learning more about senior nutrition mm-hmm. and senior health was really important to me. And I think that's one of the things that I've really been able to, looking through that lens has been very helpful.
I guess that's the goal, right? For all the clients to age as healthfully as possible. And
yes, excellent. Yeah.
One thing I was really curious to ask you about was the notion of culturally appropriate food. And I was wondering, maybe first, just for anyone listening who hasn't heard that term, I'm curious how you define it. And then I'd love to know why it's so important for the work that God's Lovely Deliver does. Yeah. Like, how does culturally appropriate food fit into the definition of healthy food?
I mean, foods from different cultures can be healthy. I think there's been kind of a, I hate to say it about my profession, but dietitians in the past have, you know, come at people with this, like, you know, here's a plate. Mm-hmm. It should look like this. And it should have, you know, broccoli and brown rice, I don't know, whatever on it. And then people who come from different cultures are like, well, I don't eat that. And that's not familiar to me. And I'm not going to do that. And it's very off-putting and it's not effective and it's not compassionate. Mm-hmm. Our menus are influenced by different cultures. Mm-hmm. And one thing, we just did a kind of a review for the first time, like a review of what are the influences, the culinary influences, like what food ways influence these recipes. And we kind of defined, you know, maybe there's 10 influences. And then we looked at the menu and looked at how many come from each of these areas. And so we're looking for holes, like, where can we get better? Do we need more Caribbean dishes? Do, you know, who are our clients, and kind of relating those things. My goal is that we have food on the menu that's familiar to everyone. Maybe not everything is familiar to everybody, but we have things on the menu that are familiar and make, you know, we want, obviously our food is medically tailored and it, you know, it's healthy, but we want people to eat, you know, part of being, you know, if you're ill and you don't eat, it defeats the purpose.
Yeah.
So our food, we want it to be nourishing and welcoming and look beautiful, but also, you know, to make people, encourage people to eat when they may not have an appetite. Mm. And so I think, you know, it has to be, we have to care about the person's, what they're going to think about the food when it comes into their home, not just what we think about it.
Yeah. Not just how much salt or whatever, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the food that goes without, you know, saying it has to have, you know, certain things like lower in sodium is, is something that's really important for everybody, but you know, it doesn't have to be broccoli and brown rice. Mm-hmm. It can be white rice. It can be pasta. It could be, you know, whatever grain, name a cream, you can name a grain, but
yeah.
We want it to be somewhat familiar to people, or familiar enough to bring them in.
Yeah.
And be respectful. So
yeah.
I hope that answers.
It totally does. And it really hits home too, because whether you're living with a chronic illness or not, I think what you just described is what we all want and what we all deserve, right? Food that we want to eat and that makes us feel good.
Yeah.
So my final question, the one I ask everyone who comes on the show, my favorite question to ask everyone I encounter in life is, what was your favorite thing to eat when you were growing up? Aside from cookies and cream ice cream, or maybe it was that.
That was older. That was actually a teenager. I have to say two things come to mind. One of them is Hungry Man TV dinners. Mm-hmm. It was a special thing. Like when my parents would go out and I had a babysitter, that was a thing, like a big to do. So I just remember that, like, oh, we get to sit in front of the TV and we get to eat it and it's so cute and it tastes good. And I love that. And I also loved, if I can tell you two things,
please. Yeah.
McDonald's fish fillet and orange soda.
I love it. I think there's something really valuable about watching the joy in your face telling me about these things and knowing that the person who's, I would imagine, for most hours of the week is thinking about healthy food and what can serve your clients. And you answered Hungry Man dinners and a McDonald's fish fillet. And I think I appreciate those answers. And I think a good reminder that just excitement and joy about what you're eating is a huge part of healthy eating.
Yeah. Both of those things have memories to me. Mm-hmm. The fish fillet and orange soda one was more like when I was visiting my grandparents. Mm. So I remember being with them. And so I think, like, you know, food is not just nutrients. It's also, there's a lot of memory and feeling and emotion behind it. And I think that's something, you know, to remember also.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing those and just that message.
Sure.
I could not agree more with it. And I think it's really important. And I am quite literally on the same page as you about that.
Dereya Walters has worked at God's Lovely Deliver for decades. It was wonderful to talk to her about what has kept her there for so long and all she does to establish and maintain so many of the relationships that keep the organization going.
Hi, I'm Dereya Walters, and I'm Senior Director of External Program Affairs at God's Lovely Deliver.
your position, the Senior Director of External Program Affairs.
Yes.
What is that? What does that mean? What are your responsibilities?
So I am responsible, right, for making sure that God's love is connected to the communities that we serve. So the intention is to make sure that every person that may potentially need our service knows about us, knows how to get enrolled, and so that we can also have strong relationships with healthcare, right? Think hospitals, clinics, health centers, you name it, right? Every primary care physician that may come across someone that is dealing with a serious illness should know how to get their patient onto our program. So I established new contracts for the agency, which is an exciting new revenue stream for the organization, right? We're a mission-based organization. We fundraise all the time, but this has opened up a door for us at least since around 2005 to bring in significant dollars to be able to serve people because a health plan is trying to keep their patient out of the hospital.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's my role. I negotiate contracts. I kind of make sure that everything runs smoothly. I try to serve more people, right, in new ways. So with everything that's been going on with healthcare being redefined in the state or in the country for that matter, but the goal is how do we make sure that every person that needs our service actually gets it? And how do we help healthcare, right, insurance plans understand that our medically tailored meals can indeed help someone address their illness? And that's where I do a lot of advocacy work with our policy team, visit Albany, making sure legislators understand we are the key intervention that can help someone like really tolerate strong medications, radiation, if they're on cancer, things like that.
The things you're talking about, working with the healthcare industry, with various insurance companies and all that stuff, I hear that and part of my brain is just like seeing so much red tape and complicated paperwork and stuff like that. And I'm just wondering, does that occur to you in your brain? And how do you navigate that kind of stuff? You're dealing with such just complicated stuff, but you seem, as you're talking about it, like you have like this huge smile on your face. It's really amazing.
Well, thanks. But I think my colleagues will tell you that I'm very kind of intentional in terms of making sure that a person, right, whoever that is, understands why God's love services are so different from, you know, what already exists, right? It's not just that someone's hungry, but if someone's diagnosed with breast cancer, like I'm a survivor, and, you know, someone who's like 30 something years old, you know, no longer can work, right, is down for the count because of the radiation and chemo, I would like every, you know, person, healthcare worker, insurance plan to understand that that person needs access to meals being delivered to their home because they don't have the stamina to go and shop and cook those meals for themselves. So yes, lots of red tape, lots of preconceived notions as to why someone might need us and why someone won't or doesn't need us. And those have been very interesting conversations, right? Because I think part of my job is to help healthcare understand that once the person leaves the hospital, life kind of resets to what it was. And you have to think about what got them into the hospital. So that's where you want to think about, okay, can she actually climb up all the stairs and carry the groceries? No, she can't. So those are the things that I'm like fighting through, kind of thing.
You're putting an actual face and a person behind like the statistic, the number.
Yeah. And well, you know, I started serving the clients, right, when we were still serving only HIV clients. And, you know, I was talking to them at the time, the medications hadn't really started working. So I was still dealing with people that were, you know, dying. And I was very aware of how quickly we had to get the meal to them. I wanted to be as compassionate and respectful of the person that I was dealing with, you know, because there's a moment where someone is afraid to ask for help. There's shame sometimes associated with that. Not that there should be, but sometimes there is.
Sure.
Wanting to make the service something that's accessible to the person, right? I want them to know that we care about them and we care about their kids. So if they can't like stand there and cook for their kids, God's love is going to feed your kids, right? Or if you can't, you know, take care of your spouse the way that you did, we're going to feed your senior caregiver because we want you both to be well, you know? So I think it's really important for us to remind ourselves, which we do, right, in the organizational culture, remind ourselves of mission and of core value. Core values are, you know, the client never goes hungry. We've got to be that urgent response to what's happening in someone's life, right? Because we, you know, we can't be the delay, right? Mm-hmm. We're the one thing that they don't have to worry about. Mm. They have other things to concentrate on, and we want them to like concentrate on that.
With those decades behind you, what keeps you motivated? What makes you want to continue to share the same message over and over and connect these dots? Like what fills your well for this work?
I think it's just, you know, understanding the experience of the clients that we serve. They're all so diverse, right? I'm, you know, my parents are immigrants. We have some clients that may or may not be citizens, which doesn't matter. But it matters that our service exists for them, right? And that's a big deal. Because I've had conversations with people that are like, well, I can't take your service because you're going to ask me this, or you're going to ask me that, or you're going to report me. And I'm like, no. You know, our goal is to help you, right? So I think for me, it's always been the act of helping the other, right? And that resonates in the mission. It resonates in the work with my colleagues, collaborating and teamwork to try to kind of achieve the success for the day. So sometimes like we just had that big snowstorm and it was like, wow, what's it, you know? And whenever that happens, we're planning ahead of time, but we're also kind of like the day of, we're worried about the safety of the drivers and the volunteers out on the road. Can we bring them back early enough before it gets too bad? So it's all about like how to help the other. And sometimes it's hard. It has been hard, right? When we expanded to include other diagnoses other than HIV, right? That was a big kind of energy within the organization, within our communities. And it was so interesting because for me, I was talking to people before we expanded our mission that we couldn't serve. Mm. Right? Because they didn't have HIV. And I thought, oh, but aren't they the same? You know, I would always, and then when we expanded, it was like, made perfect sense, right? We're helping more people. So sometimes some of my colleagues will say, our heart got bigger and it keeps getting bigger. So, you know, I think that's what the energy is that kind of motivates me. The love that we have, that title, you know, in our title is resonant for me.
Yeah. It sounds like you have this innate desire to help people. Is that something that comes instinctively to you? Like, is that something you were sort of born with? Is that something that's developed over time? Like, did anyone or any particular group of people kind of inspire that or continue to inspire that in you? Like, where does that come from in you, that pull to help?
I don't know, probably my parents, my family, you know, they were always like, you know, we come from a family of faith and it's always about what are you going to do? What are you volunteering? And, you know, who are we helping? What are we doing? And for me, right, my skill set is not necessarily in the painting of a wall, right? Or the building of the house, right? I am more a people person. So it's so funny. I volunteered somewhere and then they kind of noticed me and they're like, you know what? We're going to have you just talk over here, talk to the clients and get them all ready. And, you know, that was the thing. Like, even when I worked at the Gap was like, oh no, you're a greeter. And I was like, okay, is that really a job? Yes. You know, and I saw it as the goal is to serve a person, right? And be intentional with that. And I, as the adult, right, I'm learning about what it means to be intentional, right? Mm. To be present. And I think that's the way that I approach the work and approach the engagement. So through the agency, I've even been able to kind of work with other organizations, the HIV Planning Council and things. And while those efforts are kind of larger scale, right, thinking of the entire city, thinking about different kinds of services, housing, and whatever, all of it is something that interests me and kind of I'm like, well, how can I help? And in the helping, it's like, okay, we're going to allocate X number of dollars to housing because people in New York need housing. Or people in New York need to be able to kind of get this kind of care, mental health services, you know, even if they don't have Medicaid. So I think that sustains me.
I think a lot of people talk themselves out of doing things because it feels like, well, what difference can I make? And you seem to hold on both hands the macro, like understanding of systems and institutions, and also this micro understanding of people and individuals. I'm wondering what you would say to someone who feels like there's a need in their area, but they feel just totally uninspired to do anything. Like, what do you say to that person?
I think it's about taking the first step, right? It's once you become aware of something that the person may need, then okay, what's the first step? if it's that one person, then that's amazing, right? You're recognizing the divinity in the other, right? Mm-hmm. Even if you're preparing them that lunch, or if you're, you know, knitting them a scarf, you know, that is powerful. So I think that's the first step. And once someone starts to kind of figure it out and starts to share that, because I think it's important to also kind of share what you've realized, because others may be kind of, you know, stuck or mm-hmm. afraid to make the move. And, you know, it's always easier to move in conjunction towards something rather than, you know, isolated, right? Yeah. So we at God's Love sometimes get calls from, you name it, you know, this very small town in some other part of the country. And they're like, well, how do I get you to deliver here? And it's like, well, we can't do that right now. So how can you do this? Mm-hmm. We can, you know, and then we start to talk to them about what it means to just have nutritious food. And what it means to like work with your local university to have nutrition students help you, you know, figure out a menu and who could deliver, why, while, you know, local religious institutions, the local synagogue, et cetera, everybody can kind of do that and affect change mm-hmm. and transform a life, right? Not necessarily the person you're trying to help, but definitely yourself, mm-hmm. right? Because it's all about sometimes providing help or support. You lose sight of the fact that sometimes you end up in a position of power in the person's life. And that's not anything you want to be, right? You want to be of service. And that can either be by clicking the yes, I vote for this, or, you know, showing up, right?
Yeah, that's such an important distinction. And I'm really glad you brought that up. And I think understanding that our humanity, our liberation, all of these things are found within each other's, like, I think it's such a key distinction. And I think, you know, not parachuting into some community, like as a martyr or something, right. Like just helping to connect the dots between things that already exist and knowing that you could be on the other side of this work at any point. And with that in mind, I'm curious if you don't mind me asking you a personal question and no pressure to answer this, but you mentioned earlier that you are a cancer survivor.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, did you receive meals from God's Love We Deliver during that?
So I thought about it. I didn't. Okay. And others had offered. And the reason I didn't is because, you know, I had family kind of mm-hmm. providing for me. But I, you know, immediately recognized how important our service is for people that are just experiencing something like that. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And it's very clear because we've had other colleagues that have had things going on and it was immediate. Of course, we're going to send you meals. They were living alone and it just changes the way that the person can address their illness. You need good, healthy food to take your medications. Some of them are like really heavy stuff. And it's so amazing because I did talk to our dietitians though, and you know, they were super helpful in helping me kind of understand what radiation does, what, you know, what the medications do and how I should be eating differently, mm-hmm. things like that. So the whole package of everything that God's Love does serves so many people.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's pretty amazing. And I'm happy to hear you had access to those resources during that time and you're providing those resources and that access to so many people. At the end of a long day of work, how do you recharge or how do you discharge from that? How do you get your rest and how do you fuel this work that you do?
So my colleagues at work will tell you that I'm just a reader and a movie person and a sci-fi fantasy, you know, nut. And I love those kinds of things. I love to laugh. I like watching comedies and, you know, and I find that just moment of quick half hour comedy just kind of diffuses everything, like the tensions of the day.
Yeah.
You know, I like to walk and then listen to music. Music is so like uplifting and encouraging and kind of, you know, like, oh, dance it out. Yeah. So, you know, that's what I'm able to kind of like recharge and start again the next day.
I'm just going to end with one final question, which I just ask every single person on my podcast. When you were little, when you were a kid, what was your favorite thing to eat? What's the first thing that comes to mind?
Oh, I think it's sweet potato pie.
Mm.
My granny used to make it. She was from Virginia and it was like just decadent. You know, like I'd sit on the porch and like by myself, like, I don't need anything right now. I'm good. You know? And it was just great. It was always something amazing. I didn't have it all the time, so it like took on greater importance.
Sure. Yeah. Was it like a holiday thing?
Yeah, around the holidays and sometimes, you know, like for birthdays and things. And I think it was just that I could feel the love in it. And, you know, when I've gone to other places and it's done a little different, like, I don't know, what did you not put in it? I love to eat all kinds of food. My parents are Cuban, so having American food is like a surprise, right? And once you like, oh, this is good stuff.
Thank you so much. Thank you for everything you do and spending a little time with me today. I really appreciate it. And I'll let you get back to your very important work. But thanks for talking to me about it.
Thank you so much. This is great, Julia.
Last but certainly not least is Alyssa Wassing, the Director of Policy and Planning. She directs the advocacy work that Dereya mentioned. Alyssa and I zoomed out to talk about how she and her team expand the work that God's Love We Deliver does into policy. Please note that I've linked to HR 6774, the bill that Alyssa mentions in our conversation, in the show notes so that you can learn more about it.
I am Alyssa Wassung, and I am the Senior Director of Policy and Planning at God's Love We Deliver.
I could imagine God's Love We Deliver could exist doing what it does, you know, providing thousands of meals every day and just being this amazing kitchen and a group of volunteers to deliver the meals. That alone would be amazing and plenty, right? Like, why is it important that policy is part of this?
Oh, I love this question. Well, first, I think it's important to get some context about our intervention and about nutrition policy, just specifically around medically tailored meals. Most nutrition interventions in our country have a dedicated funding stream, like SNAP is supported by the Farm Bill, or Meals on Wheels for the elderly is supported by the Older Americans Act. There is no such thing for medically tailored meals. The only dedicated funding stream that we have is the Ryan White CARES Act, which supports only people living with HIV, and in my opinion is one of the more groundbreaking public health programs in our country. It was one of the first programs to combine medical care and support services that help keep you in that medical care. Mm-hmm. But it only covers those living with HIV. And it doesn't even cover all those that come to us for that service. So for anyone living with any other illness in New York City, across the country, community-based medically tailored meal providers are raising that money from their community. And we have incredibly generous communities across the country that have stepped up over the last 35 years. And oh my gosh, stepped up in such an amazing way during coronavirus, but that only goes so far. And so until support for this service is inculcated in policy, until there is a funding stream that supports access across the country, you're not going to get this service to all the people that need it. So by changing that structure of access, you can actually save lives and ultimately save healthcare costs.
I mean, it's amazing to hear, and it's amazing to just speak to someone who makes these kinds of changes happen, because I know that I often think like, and I think many people feel this way, like, well, that's the way things are, right? Like, or that's the rule or something. And to have that ability to know that you can be part of changing the way things are and changing the structures, that's really amazing. And I'm wondering for you, what motivates that and what keeps you going? Because I'm sure that's can be really challenging at times. And what helps you continue to do this like truly vital work that you do?
Our clients. You know, it's seeing what an impact nutrition has on the families we serve, the people we serve. Like, this is real change. I always try to remember, like, as humans, we create structures. And sometimes those structures help us do things, like good things. But sometimes those structures hinder, like, what we're trying to do. But the good news is we made those structures so we can unmake them.
Totally.
The bad news is that it takes a long time.
Yeah.
And so I think every time I see an incremental change, you know, advocacy really is like a marathon. It's not a sprint. Every single time I see a change, like this year, we had some really incredible achievements, a bill at the federal level that was introduced, a pilot that was passed at the state level. So the moment that you see those changes, you've got to celebrate them. I mean, we were talking before about like creating celebration moments in this sort of mundane time of coronavirus where every day seems the same. It's the same with advocacy, like creating those moments. And I think we do that at God's Love. And I try to do that with my team and with my partners across the country, because these are big changes,
yeah,
even if incremental.
What are some of the ways that you, or just a way, like what's the most recent way you marked that kind of celebration?
Food. Yeah. Which is at this point. Before the pandemic, we had to submit a really big government grant. And after that government grant, I got a cake and we all sat in the conference room, just the submission of this grant, because it's such a huge undertaking. And we do that really well at God's Love, I think. We like take a moment to share food, to share company, to share community, and say, hey, look what we did. And then, you know, look toward the future and move on. So food.
Yeah.
It's a great way to celebrate.
I mean, you're preaching to the choir.
I know.
What's the most fun part of your job? Like, what do you enjoy the most about it?
Well, I think I sort of look at these changes a bit like a puzzle. For some maybe bizarre reason, I have this core belief that we can figure it out, you know? And if we just put our heads together, if we just, you know, include the voices of people doing the actual work, I find that really energizing. And then taking that feedback and then kind of figuring the problem out together and coming up with a proposed solution. Like, that is so energizing to me. It gives me a lot of hope, gives me a lot of, you know, vision for the future. And I get a lot of enjoyment out of that. So yeah, I would say that maybe it's just sort of a fun puzzle to figure out, or at least I try to approach it that way, because you could approach it other ways for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a good reminder about like, your mindset is a pretty powerful thing.
Yep. Yeah. And that's not to say, of course, that I don't get frustrated. My goodness. I mean, what we've endured over time, you know, especially God's Love, starting where it did at the height of the AIDS pandemic with AIDS denialism, stigma, much of which is unfortunately still with us today. You know, it could be easy to get frustrated. And of course I do. It's frustrating that food is such an afterthought in our country. We spend more time on policy about actual fuel than fuel for our bodies. Mm-hmm. It can be demoralizing. But at the end of the day, I think because of the community that I work with and because of the people that I work with, relatively easy to turn that around into something where I have at least hope for the potential.
I think we're all affected by these policies, whether we know them or not. Like,
absolutely.
What are ways we can help make your job a little bit easier?
Well, I think first it's to raise awareness. I mean, medically tailored meals isn't necessarily, and I acknowledge this, something that just rolls off the tongue. It's not something that many people really understand, nor do they understand the impact. And so I think one of the things we've concentrated on, raising awareness that food is medicine and that it's actually backed up by statistics and data and pretty intense research, and more research gets added every day. So a lot of that information comes out on our feeds, in our articles, in our blog, covered features. And I would just share, talk to people about the fact that medically tailored meals has this impact, and also raise awareness about how it is not supported at this current moment and how supporting it could be a benefit for all. I think one of the advantages that I enjoy in advocating for access to medically tailored meals is that it's a bipartisan issue. Not only does it help people and help them become healthier, stay as healthy as they can for as long as possible, but it saves healthcare dollars. It improves health out. It's all the stuff we want to achieve, you know?
Yeah.
So I think raising awareness, and then as we come into a season of potential advocacy for the bill that I mentioned, I think that sharing about that, educating people about that will be really important as well.
Will you just like repeat the name of the bill?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we were incredibly excited to see HR 6774 introduced into Congress. It is the Medically Tailored Home Delivered Meal Demonstration Pilot Act of 2020. A little bit of a mouthful, but very important. It was introduced by our colleagues in the Food as Medicine Working Group of the House Hunger Caucus, notably Congressman McGovern, who is a huge champion of the work that we do. And what it is designed to do is establish a Medicare pilot program, which Medicare serves older Americans and also those with disabilities. And currently in mainstream Medicare, there is no access to this service. So if you are sick and hungry, you don't get a tailored meal for your illness. So this would expand access to that population, and also establish the critical link between diet, illness, and the health of older adults and disabled individuals by measuring this intervention and measuring it in different geographies and with different clinical partners. So really trying to build that evidence base where it's like undeniable that this service and access to this service makes a difference in people's lives. And so that's what the bill seeks to establish. And then if that pilot is successful, then Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has the authority then to potentially expand it across the country. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. So it's like when people hear about God's Love We Deliver, and maybe they don't live in the New York area, and you hear about your organization and how just unbelievably impactful and effective it is. And it's like, well, why doesn't this exist where I live? You know, that kind of thing. And it's like what you just described, like passing that kind of bill, making that kind of policy happen, making the undeniable.
Right.
That's how this stuff happens. And it sounds like, you know, it's complicated. And I know it's like different caucuses and groups and all this stuff. And like, there's those layers, but it's not that complicated, right? Like, it's like you make these things happen, and then more people get the help and the support that we all deserve. You are a former ballerina. You went to FIT.
Yeah.
You're a FIT trained costumer. Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you continue to dance or make costumes, but it sounds like you've had this like incredibly creative, expressive chapter. And I'm just wondering what you bring from those experiences to this policy work that you do now.
What a great question. I often think that policy and strategy and all of these words seem very dry. Right? Mm-hmm. They seem like super analytical and statistical and mathematic. And we often divorce those things from creativity. Mm-hmm. And I just totally question that divorce, right? And so, I mean, I've described how I enjoy like solving these sort of puzzles, you know, and I think there's a lot of creativity in that. Like you have to be able to imagine a different reality than what's presented to you. One of my, I'm going to butcher this, but one of my favorite Albert Einstein quotes is, if you want your kids to be smart, read them fairy tales. And if you want them to be smarter, read them more fairy tales. Like I'm not at all comparing myself to Albert Einstein at all. But like, I think it is, you know, highlighting the fact that creativity is found in imagining different realities. And I still dance. I mean, gosh, how many COVID dance parties have I had in my living room with my daughter? It's like a nightly occurrence. So yeah, I definitely still love to move and I love to create, although on a much smaller scale than before.
My final question, which is just totally just a fun question. And it's the question I ask everyone. And I only ask that you don't overthink it. When you were growing up, you mentioned kind of the origins of this work being, you know, in your childhood. And I'm just wondering, when you were growing up, what was your favorite thing to eat? What was like the thing you most look forward to? What's the first thing that comes to mind?
It's probably a dessert. My mom makes incredible pies. And I have like so many memories of making pies with her. So that was the first thing that came to mind. We also lived near like a bunch of wild blueberry, not fields, but they grow in the woods. So like blueberry pie is probably the first thing that comes to mind. Also, her pumpkin pie is incredible. Mm. I don't think I've ever achieved it, really. Yeah.
I am just like... I'm just craving a piece of pie after these conversations.
Once I said that, I was like, okay, we need to make one tonight. That'll be our other celebration.
There we go. Well, thank you so much for your time. And I hope the next time we talk, we can do it over some pie, because I think
that would be awesome.
Most appropriate. So thanks for all the work you do. It's really, it matters. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun. I'm sure we could talk for probably a couple more hours.
Yeah, for sure.
But thank you. This is wonderful.
Thanks again to OXO for supporting Keep Calm and Cook On. Head to OXO.com. That's OXO.com for more. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode, the final of season 4. I have loved making this season. I've learned so much, and I feel so grateful to share all that I've learned. I'll be back later this spring with some very special conversations. But in the meantime, please join me on my virtual book tour, including my event with God's Love We Deliver on Monday, March 15th with Carla Hall. All of the information about that and all of the events is over on juliatertian.com/events. It's also all in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or leave a review. It helps to expand these conversations. Thank you for your support and your time. Until we talk again, take care.